This program is a paid commercial announcement and in no way represents the views of WPHT or its management.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Recovery Radio. My name is Steve Martorano. We're here on Saturdays. I hope you know about that by now. We're here to talk about the disease of addiction. We've been doing this for a while now. I know everybody does. Everybody's talking about addiction. Everybody's talking about what has to be done. It's a big, big story now. We've been doing it for a long time, before it was as big a story as it is today. So we're grateful to anybody who's finding out about us. We're here to talk about this disease, most importantly, to let people know that in spite of all the bad news, and a lot of it's bad, millions of people manage to get sober. They do. Millions. So we want to leave you with that message, if nothing else, during this program. Recovery Radio is sponsored by Retreat, Premier Addiction Treatment Centers, about which more a little bit later. So we hope you got some time for us today. We have an interesting, interesting topic for you today, and a somewhat of a departure from what we've been talking about in the past couple of weeks. This story, as I said, of addiction has been with us for a very long time. It's not that the public did not know that people abuse substances and suffer as a result. That story's a very old story. But it has reached a level now of mainstream awareness that I certainly have not seen in my lifetime. This story is front and center now because of the crisis, because of the magnitude, because of the number of people who are dying every day because of substance abuse. So it's there. It's in our faces. We read about it. We hear about it. And the media certainly understands that there's a responsibility now to cover this story in a different way, perhaps a better way. And that's the topic of the program today, how the media is covering this disease, this epidemic. To that end, we welcome to the program from Temple University Assistant Professor Jillian Bear Reese. I could go on at length about what Assistant Professor Bear Reese's accomplishments have been. She's covered a lot of things as a working journalist and as a professor, and teaches a lot of various expertises at Temple. But we're going to focus on a new class that I read about called Solutions, Journalism, and Covering Addiction, an important topic. And we welcome Assistant Professor Jillian Bauer Reese to the program. Jillian, thanks for joining us. Thanks for your time.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So let me just begin at the beginning. It's a big story. It's bigger now than it has ever been. What's wrong with the way it's being covered?
I don't think I can say as a whole that everybody, is covering it inaccurately or anything. But I do think what we're seeing is a lot of sensationalized news coverage, a lot of outdated language that isn't necessarily clinical, and some inaccurate narratives that we see frequently. One example being like addicted babies, that babies are born addicted. And so, for these reasons and many more, that's why I created a class where students in the Department of Journalism could focus on reporting on solutions to addiction and the criminalization of addiction and all other issues related to addiction, where we could explore these things in the classroom.
Well, you know, that's the critique, as it were, and it was mild, I hear you, of journalism and how it's covering this or any other topic is fairly common, can be applied to any number of different aspects or stories that they cover. Certainly sensationalism is their stock in trade. Mm-hmm. Do you think that these weaknesses in the covering of this disease are a result of the kind of laziness that might set in, the familiarity with the topic they think they know how to talk about, or is it something else? Are they like the rest of the public has been for a long time, just ignorant of what they're talking about?
I'm actually not sure. I think some of it is ignorance. I've definitely, since teaching this class, I've connected with a ton of journalists who I've spoken to about the language that they're using in their reporting and how it's inaccurate, and you know, like the American Medical Association and Psychological Associations no longer use this language. And since having those conversations with them, they've actually updated the language that they're using. And so in one sense, I think there is some ignorance, but I do think that there's like this thought that from old timers that they don't want to sanitize the language that they're using to describe addiction, because it's not a topic that they should be sanitizing, that it's a gritty topic and they need to show the audience, how gritty it is.
Yeah, this is a horrible analogy, but in terms of what journalists do, it's kind of sexy when you cover it that way.
Yes.
Right?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean that is what they're looking for. They're looking for the story that cuts right through all of the everything else and gets right to the emotional component here. This disease, and that's clearly what it is, and to the media's credit, they've accepted that for a long time now. At least outwardly. Has been shrouded in myths and misconceptions for a very long time. Those myths and misconceptions were not created by the media, but I guess your course is dedicated to acknowledging that journalists now have a responsibility to kind of clear this up, right?
Yeah, yeah, and we all play a role in these narratives, and journalists have a really big responsibility to provide their audiences with accurate information about addiction, and they have a responsibility to the public to not overly sensationalize something that is a medical issue and a psychological disorder. And so, in the class, I encourage my students to write about these communities and people who are affected by addiction with empathy, and also, to produce factually and contextually accurate stories that are free from bias or stereotypes. I think the conversations that we're having in my classroom are conversations that all newsrooms should be having. For example, should we be calling people addicts? That's not, language that is used in any clinical setting anymore. The AP style book a couple years ago, or actually it was last year, actually removed the word addict from the style book. I'm in recovery, and if I would like to, on my own time, refer to myself as an alcoholic or an addict, that's fine. But the news media should not be using language to refer to people that's just not clinically accurate. I mean, it's inaccurate at this point. Mm-hmm. And the reason that so many, agencies have switched this language is because it's been proven to further stigmatize the population that's affected by addiction. The media should absolutely, follow suit, and local newsrooms should consider the language that they're using, and the language that they've placed in their style books, and follow the Associated Press's lead on that.
Jillian Bowerice, a professor at Temple University, is our guest. She teaches journalism. Jillian, for people who do not know, what is a style book?
A style book, right. So it's a set of, language guidelines that news organizations adhere to in their reporting and writing. So newsrooms, copy editors and reporters typically have a style book on their desk at all times when they're working on a story that they can, reference for, language suggestions.
Yeah, and when you talk about a style book, you're not talking about something that has to do with the grammar. You're talking about a way to describe a situation in a fashion that the organization you work for feels is best suited to the task. The highest example of that would be the Associated Press, but all the local newspapers in Philadelphia have style books, as does the New York Times or the Washington Post. These are important guidelines so that everybody's on the same page. Jillian, and I'm getting into this sort of the weeds here on journalism, but I mean, it's important for people to understand that in spite of the fact fewer and fewer people seem to be reading anything, this effort of changing the style of covering the disease of addiction should filter down even to other forms of media as well, correct?
Oh, yeah. Not just newspapers. Television stations, radio, absolutely. Glaring example of stigmatizing language that I've seen in the last month or so is the use of the word junkie, which I've actually tracked in three major publications across the United States, all in the last month, just in a news story. A reporter has used the word junkie to describe an individual who is addicted to a substance.
Yeah.
And that's actually a television station in San Francisco. The CBS affiliate there used the word junkie in a newscast last month and two separate newspapers. So we should absolutely be talking about all kinds of media and not just, you know, newspapers and digital news.
Yeah, you know, we're going to pick up on this in the next segment, but I really want to get into it, and I want you to think for a moment about a criticism that I'm sure is out there where people go, great, somebody else who wants to gild the lily here and make it look all nice and use the right language, and these people are a mess, and they're killing themselves, and they're, you know, costing us money. So we'll find out how the media sort of squares that circle straight ahead. Mm-hmm. And welcome back to Recovery Radio. We are pleased to have with us on the telephone as our guest this week, Assistant Professor Jillian Baer-Reese, and she is at Temple University, where she teaches a terrific course called Solutions Journalism, covering addiction. And believe me, if we're ever going to get past some of the misconceptions and denials and falsehoods concerning this disease, which we are obviously in the grip of, it's going to begin, believe it or not, it's going to begin in the media. No matter what you may think about the media, they can play a real big role in shaping the way society feels about a lot of things. So we're pleased to have Jillian with us, where she's teaching young minds to think differently about something like this. But Jillian, during the last, just before we went away for the break there, I pointed out, as you know, there will be people who hear about the effort of the Associated Press or folks like you to change the style or manner in which you describe this disease and all its permutations and say, you know, that's just like the media. They just want to dress this up and make it look like it's the pretty thing. How do you respond to that?
I would respond to that by calling attention to the way that we write about other diseases and disorders. And so, for example, if you're looking at another disorder like addiction, autism, for example, you would not read a story written by a journalist in which it describes an autistic, like an autistic sits on, you know, the steps of this building. However, you will read stories that describe an individual affected by addiction that say, you know, an addict, you know, sits on these steps here. And so I think we really need to, if we're accepting as a society that this is a disease and this is a disorder, we need to look to how, as journalists, we're describing other diseases and disorders and use that model when we're also talking about addiction.
What's the danger of when you individualize something that's something like addiction or as you point out, autism? What's the effect on the reader or listener when you do refer to someone in an individual sense who has this problem?
So if you're referring to an individual as an addict, for example, or a junkie, as I just mentioned,
more colorfully, yeah.
Yeah. So there have been studies done on people with, and actually the official language now is substance use disorder, which is just like a spectrum. And addiction is typically, the like the worst case of substance use disorder, or at least that's what clinicians will use to refer to the worst case of substance use disorder. And so there have been studies done on how like clinicians are likely to treat people that are referred to as substance abusers versus people with substance use disorder. And so the studies have actually shown that even a highly trained medical clinician is more likely to negatively judge somebody described as an abuser as opposed to a person with a substance use disorder. So that shift, like making that shift to using person first language, will have a positive impact on how an individual will treat that person with that disease or disorder. And so if you think about it, if that's how, you know, a highly trained clinician will respond to a word like a substance abuser or addict, then think about how an untrained person who's just a member of society will respond to those words. They'll likely have a negative perception of that person and think that it's the person's fault and that it's a moral failing,
yes,
that they are where they are today and struggling with this disorder, and it will absolutely have, you know, a negative impact.
Because they screwed up. Yes, when you speak in those individualized or person ways, when you focus on that, you're right. The public tends to focus on an individual. They must have done something wrong. That's seeing the tree and not the forest. And the other thing you just described, I think, and this is worth considering, is that the criticism to this effort might be, more political correctness, more political correctness, instead of saying, no, we got to change the way we talk about these things because it will ultimately change the way we think about them. Is that the process that we're undergoing here?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely, absolutely. And the way, you know, the language that we're using in the media affects the public perception, and that public perception shapes the policies that we develop in this country to respond to these issues. We have a ton of issues related to drug policy in this country, and treatment options for people. I mean, there's no like federal standard for providing treatment for people in the United States, which is crazy. and we put a lot of people in jail who are struggling with an illness. And so the idea here is that by shifting this language so that it's aligned with the language that we use to describe other clinical issues, diseases and disorders, that we will affect public perception and change policy in this country to better support people who are struggling with this.
Back to our guest, Jillian Bauer-Reisch, straight ahead. But first, a reminder of Retreat, Premier Addiction Treatment Centers. I tell you this each and every week. I have a mandate from them, even though they pay the bills, not to be up here shilling you about the, you know, treatment, their facilities. They're world class. Their reputation is well established. You can check it out for yourself. They're sponsoring this program so that it may inform people about the situation regarding substance abuse. That's the long and short of it. Retreat's great. Can they help you? If they can, they will. But they stand ready now just to answer questions for you. I'm going to give you their phone number. And as I said, if they're the people that can help you, they will. If they can just answer questions for you, they're there for that. This is one of those phone numbers I give each and every week and say, and mean, I hope you never need to use it. But if you do, it could be a difference maker. 855-859-8808. Again, they'll answer your questions about anything you've heard on the program or any questions you have about substance abuse and treatment. Retreat, Premier Addiction Treatment Centers. 855-859-8808. From Temple University, we've been speaking with Assistant Professor Jillian Bauer-Reisch. She is teaching a course at the school called Solutions Journalism Covering Addictions. Important stuff going on for the next generation, and there will be another generation of journalists on how to cover something. I'm not saying properly, but in the manner that will do the most good, I guess, is or the least harm, and that's what Jillian is about with her young students. How'd you get into this racket? Tell us a little about yourself.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, first and foremost, I'm actually a person in long-term recovery from addiction, and so that's really how I started. I was a journalist first, and entered recovery second, and so very early on in my recovery, I actually started a documentary photography and like audio storytelling project on stories of recovery and life on the other side of addiction. And so I, about a year into my sobriety, I started traveling the country, and I went to about half the states, and I interviewed 150 different people and photographed them who all identified as living in recovery. And so through that process, For each person I interviewed, I probably connected with four or five people who were in their network. And I started hearing, a lot of different stories about barriers to treatment that I, as, like a middle-class white woman, hadn't faced when I needed to enter recovery. And so I started to do a little bit more digging and realized that, here I have access to so many talented student journalists that I could tap into to help me investigate some of these barriers and also solutions to the barriers, which is really the bulk of what we're doing in this class is reporting on responses to social problems. So the ways in which the community is responding to, the addiction crisis in Philadelphia. And so my recovery has definitely, played a part, a big part in this. One of my favorite theories is that the opposite of addiction is connection. And I've definitely connected with a lot of people throughout this process.
Well, that's a great point, because if anybody needed any more information about why an effort like your course is necessary, it's just to do that. You're right. The disease isolates people, makes them feel alone and doomed, and changing the way you report about this can help them understand that it's there's a lot of people out there and they view this differently. Is it troubling at all, or should we be troubled at all, that all of this awareness on how to cover the disease is set against the backdrop of it spreading now into places where it historically didn't seem to be a problem? You know what I mean? When heroin got to the suburbs in a big way, suddenly journalists, pundits, law enforcement people, the courts all said, gee, this is a problem.
Yeah. Yeah. The complexion has absolutely changed in recent years, and that's absolutely undeniable. And one thing that I do on a personal level is recognize my privilege, and I recognize that I personally had a different complexion, or were male, would very likely not be in the position that I'm in today, to encourage students to look at this differently and then enter the workforce as journalists and have that impact. And so it's absolutely troubling, and that's something that we talk about in the classroom. However, I'm unable to jump in a time machine and go backwards and change the way in which, the crack epidemic was covered, during the 80s. But I can control, the impact and my efforts that I have, now.
Yeah, going forward.
And moving forward. Yeah. And we've discussed this at length in my classroom, and we've actually kind of veered away from the language of like the opioid epidemic, which I don't necessarily, I don't buy into the quote unquote opioid epidemic. I think we have an addiction crisis. Mm-hmm. But I worry about the media framing everything as the opioid epidemic, because when opioids goes away, whenever that may be, there will be other drugs there, and there will be people addicted to those drugs. And so so these are again discussions that we've had in my classroom, and we've attempted to come to our own conclusions and our own approaches to those discussions. But I think other, newsrooms should absolutely, be having them.
You have, you've given a lot of talks on this and other topics. What's the reaction? I mean, I'm you see young, eager minds every day, and you're trying to set them on the right path. What's the reaction to, what are the reactions to these changes in working newsrooms?
In working newsrooms, yeah. I mean, I think there, I think there's definitely some, some pushback. Regarding language, there's absolutely pushback. And I think some of that pushback does come from this understanding that the media did not sanitize these issues, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, and therefore they should not, sanitize them now. So mm-hmm. that's, an excellent counter argument. However, again, going back to just language, we should be using like accurate language to describe like something that is classified as a disease and a disorder. At this point we know more about addiction too. That should be, encouraging us to cover it a little bit.
Cover it wisely. Yeah. Well, but again, it's unfortunate that this issue is what frames that argument, but there's a, mm-hmm. it's a broader question here. Everything should be dealt with this way. Mm-hmm. Everything should be, reported upon and broadcast and printed to the public on a kind of solution based mm-hmm. best methods technique. And it's got really has less to do with sanitizing than just doing it right. How do you, what's bringing young people into journalism these days? I mean, they're not coming in just to cover the story. I mean, bringing them in?
I don't actually have access to like our data that we've collected on our students, but I think a lot of students come in, like we have different groups of students. A lot of them, the ones that I'm finding in this class and another class that I'm teaching in Kensington in the fall is like people who really want to like change the world, right? Which is great. It's awesome. They're like excited to change the world's perspective on a variety of issues. So I think there's that, most of our students, or at least I would hope most of our students, are interested in finding the truth and reporting real news.
While it still exists, yeah, right.
Yeah.
right.
But I don't want to go too far down that road. But there's definitely that. But I think at the core, the students that come into our program are interested in telling stories. And
yes,
so
right, that's a great point. Because everything begins with a good story and the ability to tell it honestly and clearly. Jillian, we have another segment here now, and I want to get too deeply into it right now. But I looked at a lot of the activity that you've engaged in, the pieces you've written, and some of the speaking engagements you've made. You're not afraid to take strong issues mm-hmm. on positions that your point of view, I guess, would be considered controversial or thought provoking. And I'd like to pick up on a couple of those, not least of which is safe injection sites, and you believe journalists should carry Narcan. That's interesting.
Yeah.
And we will get into it straight ahead. Our guest has been from Temple University, Assistant Professor Jillian Bauer-Reese. She is teaching, among many other courses she's handled there, something called Solutions Journalism Covering Addiction. And it's great. It's an effort that Jillian is telling her students about that's now taken hold in places like the Associated Press, the New York Times, the Philadelphia Inquirer, to cover this disease in a more thoughtful and comprehensive way, and not rely so much on stereotyping or cliches or myths. And it's an effort we certainly applaud here on the program. Jillian, you give lots of talks in lots of places about this, as well as teaching it. You've taken some positions that probably have brought you a little notoriety. I mean, I know you have advocated in support of safe injection sites. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. They save lives and money. So, why shouldn't I?
And the other thing is another kind of harm reduction notion, and that you think journalists should be carrying, if they're going to cover this story anyway, they should be carrying the drug Narcan, which can reverse a deadly overdose. Is that right?
Yeah. I think it's at least a question that newsrooms should be asking, and a discussion that they should be having if they are going out into the community. And now, you know, an increasing number of reporters are identifying themselves as addiction reporters and covering, you know, the opioid crisis. And so one of the things that surfaced from the class that I'm teaching, the first semester that I taught it about a year ago, is that one of our guest speakers, while she her news team at NBC 10 was covering an addiction story, they found somebody overdosing, and they didn't have any naloxone on them, and they ended up having a discussion there about whether they should carry it, and I thought it was something worth investigating, and so the more I investigated, I started to find journalists that were already carrying it, notably Mike Newell, who is in Kensington frequently and has actually assisted since I talked to him for that story. It was actually the night before the story was published. He ended up assisting in saving somebody from an overdose because he was carrying Narcan on him.
No.
And so, you know, typically, you know, in journalism, we're supposed to stay removed from the story. We're not supposed to be part of the story. And so I think that's, you know, where the debate enters. And journalists, some journalists think that they should be, you know, completely disconnected and removed, and they should not be carrying it, while others who are interviewing people who are using drugs and nodding and in these areas think that they should actually have it on them.
Yeah, it's a little nutty, though, because nothing in journalism says that if you're covering a ship sinking and have the ability to throw someone a lifesaver, that you shouldn't do it because you're interfering with the story. That's ridiculous.
Yeah. I mean, absolutely. And I think, I mean, everybody I talked to agreed that if they encountered an overdose, they would obviously call 911. I think where it gets a little bit murky is if you're, you know, a regular reporting in an area and the people who use there know that you have Narcan, like, are you somehow
enabling,
encouraging that? I mean, that's like a counter argument, like that you're encouraging them or you're just waiting for them to overdose so that you can film, you know, somebody Narcaning them from
yes,
your
indeed.
News team. But
that murkiness is worth talking about here for a second, because when you advocate, or others like you, for safe injection sites, or talk about the carrying of Narcan by working journalists, some people, and maybe this is another fault of the way the media is handling this, some people take that harm reduction effort and turn it in and think it's encouragement or enabling the situation. Has the media done a good enough job in explaining the difference between harm reduction and enabling the problem?
I mean, it depends on I guess, like, which member of the media you're talking about. I mean, it's I definitely think at the Inquirer they have extensively covered the safe injection thing through not just their news coverage, but also like their opinion pages through columnists like Mike and other people who have written in frequently on the issue, and they've repeatedly showed data and research that show that this does not enable drug use and that it saves lives, but there is just a population that is refusing to accept that science for whatever reason, which I think is a larger issue.
Every time along the path here, anybody has proposed anything that suggested that you were encouraging or enabling this disease, there was pushback. I mean, the Good Samaritan laws, which allowed people to phone for help during an overdose and not be arrested for drug use, were always pushed back against.
Yeah.
And again, I know this is a criticism of the media, but I don't think they have done enough to explain to the public that there's a difference between harm reduction, which is merely trying to save somebody's life, and encouraging the behavior. I think we need not to lose that argument. Anyway,
yeah,
go ahead.
On that topic, I mean, one thing that the media absolutely has not done well enough is really delve into like medication-assisted treatment.
Absolutely.
And what's happening surrounding medication-assisted treatment. And because what's happening is you know, you'll go to a 12-step group or a rehabilitation center or a recovery house, and they oftentimes do not offer or allow for medications like Suboxone.
Yep.
Or Suboxone and methadone.
Yeah, but fortunately, that's changing, and that's changing quickly.
It is changing, but I think the media could better point out that there is a bias like surrounding this, and that people are being discriminated against when they take these medications, even though the medications save lives and
yes,
they're actually the most effective form of treatment for opioid use.
Well, that's an example. So, that's an example of old thinking that will be changed by better reporting and writing. And we thank you because that's what you're doing. You're making that effort with your course at Temple. Jillian Bauer-Reese, thanks for joining us so much. I hope we can have you back again.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Appreciate it. Hey, everybody, enjoy the rest of the weekend, and please look for us here on Saturday's Recovery Radio. Bye-bye.
This program is a paid commercial announcement and in no way represents the views of WPHT or its management.